I've had a listen to the album, and it's probably, I don't know, it's got a bit more variety than the last one. Would you agree?
I guess I would agree, yeah, because I've heard this same feedback from quite a few others as well. And it feels like that to me as well, now that you mention it.
Okay. You like your key changes though, don't you?
Well, yeah, that just happened somehow. I don't know. It's whenever you write a song, you really just have to listen to the song, and like it speaks to you. It tells what it needs, so to speak. So writing process is more of a listening process. And I just heard every time at those parts where there's a key change or whatever else, things, they just are there because they asked for it. It sounds kind of weird, but you gotta trust your intuition when you're dealing with things like this.
No, that makes sense. Do you find that your singer has any say in it? Because I'm guessing that they don't want to sing really high.
Well, actually, I wrote like everything, but he once told me that, Anton, don't worry. Like, don't worry too much about the key, because he considers it this way, that if he cannot sing something in a different key, I'm talking about like normal melody stuff, not crazily high stuff, it means that he needs to practice more, then he's not good enough singer. That's what he told me. So I really respect that kind of attitude, that the guy is like hungry to improve himself with his own art, which is singing, and I really like that type of like mentality. Same thing with me and the others as well. You know, we don't settle for less. You know, when you're only as good as the weakest part of the chain, so to speak. You know.
Yeah, I understand that. If you look at the album as a whole, what would you say is the overall theme?
Well, lyric-wise, there's 5 songs based on Berserk, the Japanese anime and manga. But musically, there was no real theme. It just, well, now it seems like it's 80s theme all over the place, but it wasn't calculated. We didn't aim for that. We just chose the songs based on our own like intuition and personal opinions. Somebody likes one song more, somebody likes other song more, and in the end the wholeness turned out to be very 80s, which is kind of the musical theme, I guess, of this, one of the musical themes of this album. But it was kind of sheer luck, not luck, but you know, coincidence that it turned out this way.
It's not just that you got your big choruses in there, but there's also like your synth bass and some of the drum sounds. Yeah, it's very 80s.
Yeah, I guess it comes from my love towards Italo disco and synth pop in general. But there was that stuff already in the previous album also, but maybe not as much. But, you know, it just happens naturally.
Well, I guess
in heavy metal. Yeah, I just want to add that in heavy metal is the only genre where you can really go to any extremes, like, as you want. That is the most free genre, like, to experiment ways of music.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, look, Priest did it with Turbo in 86.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you think that you were, you know, intending to have flute and stuff like that on there? I mean, you've got Ocean Deep, which is quite an interesting song.
Well, I love those types of instruments as well, so. But that ballad itself came to be on the album quite. Well, the story is this, you know, there was another ballad that was supposed to be on the album, but I didn't have lyrics ready for that. We had a, like, very, very, very tight schedule with this album. It was barely ready before the Nightwish support tour, which started in November. It was like a few days before the tour, the mastered version of the album was ready. So to save time, I realized, okay, there's another ballad, Ocean Deep, which already had like both verses were written only the chorus needed some lyrics. So it saved a lot of time to, at some point when we were already recording the stuff, to change the ballad. And Ocean Deep was born, it's one of the newest songs. It was born spontaneously, not spontaneously, but you know, it was in the middle of the night when I woke up straight from a dream. I wrote the song based on the dream, on the person who I saw in the dream. And it's a song about longing, obviously. Mm. And the lyrics and the melodies were born almost in one go when I woke up in that night. So luckily it happened. And thus we got this ballad on the album.
Yeah.
And, you know, my favorite composer is James Horner, the one who wrote Braveheart soundtrack and Titanic soundtrack. And I guess I have, like, I'm fond of those type of melodies and instrumentations, what he has written. So it also kind of comes naturally already from me. I've absorbed so much from him, like, inspiration wise. So the flute thing is, I could say it's probably thanks to him, or like.
Okay, and who was the was a female vocalist on there as well?
No, Yannis is singing everything, actually.
Okay, don't tell him I said that.
But it's funny because when Blind and Frozen came out, everyone was thinking that the verses were sang by a female, but it's Yannis singing those as well on the first album. So we wanted to continue to use his like rich soundscape of his voice, mm-hmm. interpretation styles. So I think it's a good thing that he can do that many things. He's not a one-dimensional singer. He is really, like, you know, there's, like, not even two in one, but it's, like, many, many different types in one package. So that's great when you have someone who can do those rich interpretations.
Yeah, I understand. I mean, if you look at the song No Surrender, it's almost doing best Halford you can imagine.
Yeah.
The song, going back to Ocean Deep, though, the solo is interesting. How you've got first one that's more slower and building with the way the song builds, and then second one is just this full on shred by comparison. Is that just naturally the way that it developed?
Yeah, it did. Well, actually, the first solo was supposed to be played with a clean guitar, but then I tried it with a slide. Sorry, not slide, but with a whammy bar, more like what it is now on the album. And I thought, hey, well, it seemed more like, I don't want to use the word epic because it's overused nowadays, but it has certain, like, stronger feel when I did it with distortion and with this whammy bar. Mm. But it was pretty much written solo. Usually I don't write them beforehand, but that solo was more or less written. And the next solo is Kasperi's solo, the more metal solo. And he always writes his solos, like, note by note for every song. It's like his solos are like small songs within a song. And he's a great guitar player, and whenever he does that, I feel like, okay, I have a challenge. Like, he puts up that great playing, and music-wise and technically also. So I feel like, okay, I really have to, like, put some effort, extra effort to not, you know, to have this equal quality. You know, it sucks when you have, like, two guitar solos and the other solo is totally, like lame, and the other one is great. So yeah. I wanted to keep it, like, equally good.
Yeah, definitely. How did you divvy up the solos on the album? I mean, is it? I was under the impression that it was largely yourself.
Sorry, what was the question? How did we divide the solos?
Yeah.
50-50, more or less. We actually wrote it down in the booklet with the lyrics, whatever the there's the physical version of the album out. Anyone can read the booklet and see who is playing what solo. But we actually in the YouTube second single release, "Die by the Blade," we also included lyrics there, and it says that Kasperi plays the solo there. And because for some people it might be interesting, for maybe not for the most of the people, but I know, like, since I'm a guitar player myself, I would be curious, okay, which one of the players is playing the solo, if there's like two guitarists in a band and both play solos. So we were thinking, hey, it's not a big deal if we just write one note, one line somewhere that this guy plays the solo. It's like, maybe someone will be like satisfied with knowing that fact.
That's cool. Yeah, I like that kind of stuff.
Small details. Yeah.
Like, you've got the song, the single, which is Sweet True Lies, and then you've got Repentless, and both of them have got some impressive guitar work in it. But I found that Repentless very much reminded me of, I guess, something that maybe Impella Terry or Malmsteen might do chord progression wise.
Okay, okay, interesting. Well, I can't say that I thought like Impella Terry or Malmsteen at all during writing that song, but I guess there are so many influences. Like when you have listened to music throughout your whole life, and many things, they come from the subconscious. If you really start to observe the songs and its nuances, where they come from, then I might be surprised even myself where something comes from. It's sometimes hard to trace, but definitely didn't have like Malmsteen or Impella Terry on my mind when I was writing that. Like I said earlier, it's more of this listening process. The song tells itself what it needs, and you just write, you know, riff after riff, or melody after melody, keyboard thing after keyboard thing, vocal melody after vocal melody. You just listen like it's like part by part, like instrument by instrument, and then you will trust that and write it down. And then Repentless became Repentless. I have no better explanation.
No, no. That's fair. Just, I'm just curious if how you do things differently so that you don't end up repeating yourself. Like, do you do songwriting on a piano or something like that, just occasionally?
Occasionally, yeah. I like play with the keyboard or the controller that I have connected to my studio computer. But mostly, I write the songs just at the desk. I just sit down and start typing. But with the guitar also, I write quite a lot. You know, it's easy. You know, just grab the acoustic guitar or electric guitar, not even plugging it in, just, you know, grab it, and it takes like 1 second, and then you can like try out some ideas like instantly. The bad thing with the, if you don't have any instrument and you have an idea, you always have to type it, and it takes more time to know how it sounds. But usually I know already beforehand how it sounds, because, you know, you have the understanding of music and you can really imagine it in your head. Okay, if I play this chord progression with this melody, I already know how it's gonna sound like. But with the guitar, it's nicer when you have the real sound. You don't have to imagine it, you just play it, and, you know, it's more like lively. It's more alive that way.
That's cool. Just out of interest, are you using, is it Ibanez guitars or PRS or Caparison? What are you using?
Well, I've used Jackson since 2014. Well, I don't have any deals with Jackson or Ibanez or any of those. But I just chose the guitar because it looked cool and it had all the technical things that needed to be there. You know, 24 frets, whammy bar, and it like stays in tune good enough. Yeah. So I like guitars also, like, from the visual perspective. You know, it's important that I like that visually. And
Did your interest in Wasp ever lead you to, you know, BC Rich?
Yeah, actually, why not? I love those guitars as well. I haven't bought any BC Rich guitars, but maybe I will try one of those and buy one or two in the future.
Nice.
Not a bad idea.
Well, did you ever imagined, I guess, when you're starting out with, you know, Battle Beast, that you'd be eventually doing your own band, opening with Nightwish and touring with Wasp?
No, it was like, every time it felt like a dream come true when you get to tour with bands like that. But I've been very lucky, because with Battle Beast we supported Nightwish in 2012, and now with Beast in Black, Beast in Black's very first show was supporting Nightwish, and then like last year it was the 6-week tour, so it's like a privilege. And when it comes to Wasp, well, it's still one of my top 5 bands, but you know, the tour didn't end up well. Maybe you haven't heard, but it was supposed to be like 1 month tour or a bit longer. We only played 4 shows, and well, the reason was that no one else than Blackie Lawless himself, like, basically, we didn't really meet him face to face at any times, but you know, it just was very weird how they behave and how they like treated us on the tour, coming from a professional band that's been around for decades, and like, we really don't understand why to make it so difficult when you are touring 2 bands together. Like, so at some point when we actually said it already in this Finnish internet magazine, so I can say it also now, that the last straw was that when they started to, you know, kind of ask money, well, blackmail money from us, we thought, hey, like, we're not paying you anything, so we are not going to continue this tour if that's the way how you want it.
Nice.
Yeah, but I don't want to go more into details, but that was like already a public like statement. Yeah. Immediately after, that was the last straw.
Oh well,
because it wasn't agreed, you know, beforehand that it would go like that. When you come up with things like that in the middle of tour, it's unacceptable.
Don't meet your heroes.
Yeah, but anyway, it's one funny thing is that many people still ask me about that tour, especially those who know what happened. Like in this month, I've had already quite a few interviews where they wanted to ask about this tour, what happened. So in a way, it was a positive thing. You know, it caused extra buzz around the band and some more interest towards the band. So, you know, they say any publicity is good publicity. Well, for us, it served well.
Yeah, fair enough. Just quickly, is there any chance you might tour Australia then?
Well, we'd really love to. I think the correct way would, in my opinion, would be supporting some big band there and to make ourselves known, or to come to some big festival and make ourselves known, because if you jump straight into the cold water, so to speak, you like headline tour, we would play for 20 people in small clubs if we just go directly headlining there. So that's why it has to be done in a correct way. And when people know about Beast in Black there, like more people know about it after like some big support tour, then we can next time, second time come for a headline tour. So I hope that there will be soon some good opportunity to support some big band there.
Okay.
We really would love to come there.
Yeah. Just quickly, final question for you. The artwork is, you know, quite striking. Is that the kind of thing that lends itself to being, you know, your vinyl type effort, where you can sit there and really appreciate the album in a big vinyl release?
Yeah, there's vinyl releases coming also. The album artwork is like very important for a band that has a like strong image and character. For us, you know, Beast in Black, there has to be this beast, and on every album cover, like Iron Maiden has Eddie, so. And for us, it's important to have that, and yeah, we like that a lot. Like, it's a friend of mine, good friend of mine, Roman Ismailov, who made it for the debut album and for the second one as well. We just wanted something different, like this time, even though there's the Beast, but if you compare like the colors, it's more like eye candy-ish compared to the first album, which didn't have that like vivid colors. But the character is there, but also the character is different, and there's also this female on the cover as well, so style is the same, but with like new recipes.
Yep, indeed. Look, thank you very much for chatting to us. This is for Loud Online.
All right, thank you.
So we'll get it up there pretty soon, okay?
Okay, great.
Right,
thanks for the talk. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.